Okay, so I'm going to address three basic areas. One, what is the book about? And secondly, what did the research involve? And then finally, the thesis and the writing style. And I'm going to go over the basic argument of the book and the basic, how it was written. So what is the book about? Generally speaking, my book is about the meaning and definition of community, and more specifically, ethnic community. And it focuses in on the Japanese-American community in New York from obviously a historical perspective. Being a historian. But also a sociological perspective, as I found that was necessary in order to articulate and relate this story. Beyond this general framework, the book relates personal stories of individuals and families in the community and further describes the environment in which they lived. And this is for the reader to understand their lives and how they related to one another and to the larger New York City community. And hopefully the reader can get some understanding and be able to not just understand the Japanese New York community, but also maybe to have a connection to them and to see how their lives maybe relate to your lives today, even though this is roughly 100 years ago. And understand how they lived during their time as well. So this project emerged from a question. The question was, where is the Japanese-American community in New York City? And I previously spent a lot of time discussing how I came to that question, but I'm not going to address that this evening. And I think it is mentioned in the introduction. You can read about how I came to this question. I think it's a fairly, you might come to this question, too, if you ever thought about Japanese-Americans or have had any interest in Japanese-Americans, because in New York City, which is obviously a very diverse community, we have Chinatown, we have Sunset Park and Flushing, where, large populations of Chinese-Americans live. Harlem, Spanish Harlem, Little Italy, Belmont in the Bronx, Bensonhurst in Brooklyn, Staten Island, where large concentrations of Italian-Americans, and Spanish Harlem, Latinos, and Harlem, traditionally African-Americans. Of course, it's changing now, as Chinatown is changing as well. But historically, these are where the communities first became associated with these ethnic ghettos, as they were called. Korean-American communities in Flushing and in Long Island, Filipino-American communities in Woodside, Queens, South Asian American communities in Jackson Heights, Richmond Hill, Lexington Avenue in the 20s. So I was wondering when I first came to New York, which is now over 20 years ago from Los Angeles, I was wondering, well, where is the Japanese American community in New York? Because you have Japan towns in the West. And I come to New York, I think, well, there must be a Japanese American community here. Because obviously New York being the center of trade and business, I know there are many Japanese businessmen who lived here, and I knew just from general population data there was a sizable Japanese American community in New York City. So that's where this question arose. I came across this New Yorker article from 1940, which this cartoon is difficult to understand outside the context of the article, but the salesman represents Japanese Americans or ethnic Japanese in New York. So he's saying, I'd like to introduce myself. So that's supposed to represent Japanese Americans, because in 1940, New Yorkers didn't really know there was a Japanese American community. When they saw an Asian face, they assumed it was a person who was Chinese. And there really wasn't any connection at all with Japanese. So I found in the late 90s that there were pockets of Japanese and Japanese Americans living or who had lived in various parts of New York, various small sections, parts of Westchester, Fort Lee, New Jersey. And there had been historically communities in parts of the Bronx, in Flushing, and in other parts, Midtown Manhattan. You know, there were streets where you have businesses and restaurants, 41st Street near the New York Public Library, 9th Street near NYU, West 9th Street. So there had been these pockets, and still are, these, you know, small areas. But there really wasn't a central location. There had been at one time after World War II, when people from the West Coast came from the American concentration camps, and they resettled in New York, and many of them resettled around Columbia University. There were apartment complexes that were relatively low cost, and many people rented in those complexes, and a small community did form there. Joe Oyama had an Oriental food shop, and that area tended to be the center of the community around 110th Street or so. There's also some Japanese Christian churches, Japanese Buddhist church, they're also in the area as well. But that community gradually disappeared as people moved away, went back to the West Coast, moved to other parts of the country, and it disappeared. And other than that, though, had there been, you know, another Japanese American community, or, you know, where was it? Was that the only one, or had there been communities before that? So that was my question that I started to examine. Now, I found out just now we have another community here, well, sort of a community, this Japan Village, which is in Sunset Park, which is really a very large a supermarket with restaurants and many food stalls. And I believe it's the largest outside of Japan. And this just opened in last fall. So we still have these, you know, these small pockets that are still forming, but why was there no central community? Or why was the only central community this small community around Columbia? And so I thought, well, thinking about the Columbia community, maybe it had something to do with World War II. Maybe that's the reason why no central community had formed before then. And you know, maybe there was some type of, you know, racism, possibly that was involved. So I did find this early on in my research about Mary LaGuardia protesting the resettlement of Japanese Americans from the camps into New York City, as well as residents of a street in Brooklyn who protested a hostel that had been established to help evacuees resettle. And the governor of New Jersey, Walter Edge had also opposed the resettlement of Japanese Americans from the camps in New Jersey. So my initial thought was, well, maybe that's the reason. Maybe there was just because of racial, you know, prejudice, maybe that was the reason why there was no central community. Maybe this had blocked it somehow or another. However, then I located a master's thesis that was written by a Columbia graduate student, and it was published in 1940, so this is before the war, before World War II. And in her thesis, she had a map that she had put together from census data in the 1930 U.S. Census. And this map, which I replicate in the book, it shows that in 1930, this is just for Manhattan, but gives you an idea that the population even then was very dispersed and scattered. There was a small concentration in Upper Manhattan in Fort George, and those were mostly families for the most part. And then in Lincoln Square, where Lincoln Center is now, there was a street that had mostly bachelor laborers and small businesses. Japanese companies and their employees were located in various parts. Mostly the Japanese American branches of Japanese banks were in Lower Manhattan in the financial district. You had a Japanese silk district, which was in Murray Hill in the 30s, East 30s. There was a Japanese Chinaware district, which was in Chelsea around 5th Avenue and 19th and 20th Streets. Japanese businessmen lived, for the most part, in apartments on Park Avenue in Midtown. You also had some managers and executives of Japanese companies who lived on West End Avenue on the Upper West Side. So even they were the Japanese businesses were also somewhat scattered around. And the various Japanese American social organizations were in various parts. So they were not together, but they were in different parts of Manhattan. So from this thesis, I realized, well, this arrangement, this spatial separation existed well before World War II. So that was my question again, is how do I explain this? Why was it like this? And so I started at the beginning with the Oceanic Group, which were really the first Japanese to settle permanently in the United States. Not all of them, but a couple members of this group became permanent residents of the United States. And they came to this country in 1876, and their purpose was to establish commercial trade. So these were businessmen or very young, people entering into business, and they wanted to establish trade between America and Japan. So porcelainware and silk were the two primary goods that were involved. Perhaps the best known was Ryoichi Arai, who's on the far left, sitting down. And he was born in 1855 and came here in 1876, when he was 21 years old. And he had a substantial role in making Japanese raw silk the primary source for American silk manufacturers. By 1929, so this is roughly almost 50 years later, more than that, Japanese raw silk accounted for 95% of U.S. raw silk imports. So it really went from about close to zero to 95%. And these were the people that helped to start this. Now, Ryoichiro Arai, this is actually the cover of the book, and he's seated there in the chair. This is from 1887, and this is 2 years after he married Kazu Ushiba. And she's standing on the left. And the person in the middle is the daughter of the boarding house operator where they initially lived. So he actually had lived in this boarding house when he first came to the U.S. And then after he was married, they lived there for a couple years. And eventually, he became quite wealthy, and they moved to Riverside, Connecticut. Now, so this really wasn't a community. It was just a small group of businessmen. The first actual community was in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And this community established roughly around 1886, mid-1880s, and it consisted primarily of working-class bachelor men. And many of them had been on ships, commercial ships, Navy ships, and they had jobs working as mess boys, or cooks, things of that nature. And eventually a community formed near the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So they had small businesses, they worked as manual laborers, they worked in restaurants, they had various jobs such as those. This area was known as the Brooklyn Tenderloin. Now, I had someone actually write to me and said that he wasn't aware of a Brooklyn Tenderloin, but it actually was a very small area. It was a red light district, actually. Very small area along Adams Street. And I think the official name is the Adams Street Tenderloin District. So this was just west of the Navy Yard. And many of the men lived, again, these were primarily almost all men, they lived on Sand Street, which is that sign there. It was kind of interesting, though, as I went to the museum that was recently established in the Navy Yard, Building 92, and there really isn't any mention at all that there was a Japanese-American community there or that these Japanese immigrant men worked at the Navy Yard. I think someone said that there was a piece of pottery that looked like it had an Asian motif, and that may have been something that one of the laborers created, although the museum doesn't really make that connection. So this community, and it could be because the community wasn't around for very long. Well, it was around roughly from 1886 until about the early 1900s, about 1910 or so. And what happened was the Navy issued orders in 1892 and then again in 1906, and these orders essentially prohibited the hiring of non-citizens. And as some of you probably know, Asian immigrants were not allowed to become American citizens. And that lasted for quite some time until World War II, really into the 50s for many of them. And as a consequence, because they could not obtain citizenship, these Navy orders effectively barred them from working for the Navy, either as enlisted men or as civilian workers. And as a consequence of that, the community around the Brooklyn Navy Yard gradually disappeared. People went elsewhere to find jobs, is what happened, essentially. So this is how my research started. And I want to talk now about the research process that was involved. As you might have already figured out, I could find very little information in the published history about the New York Japanese American community. There was one book, which turned out only had one chapter on the Japanese American community in New York. There also was one essay, which was about the Oceanic group. And that was essentially it in terms of the peer review scholarship. So I started to wonder, well, is there going to be enough information for me to be able to write about this community? And it was that around that time that I went to this bookstore, Dinosaur Hill on East 9th Street, and I found a oral history that Yuri Kochiyama, the human rights activist, had given to the St. Mark's workshop. And it was from there that I realized that maybe if I have, more oral histories, I might be able to write the history of this early community. And this is when I was a graduate student at NYU working at my PhD, and one of my advisors had said, yeah, that might work. If you can get enough oral histories, maybe you can write something about it. So I began contacting several local organizations, Japanese American organizations, kind of moved from one organization. So I would call, say, the Japan Society, and they said, well, no, you need to talk to the Nippon Club. So I called the Nippon Club, and they said, oh, no, you need to contact the Japanese Association. And I contacted the Japanese American Association, and they said, well, try contacting the churches. So finally, I went to the Japanese American United Church, and I met many of the longtime church members who had lived in New York, in some cases have been born in New York, so in some cases going back to the 1920s, and also some who had come after or during the war, World War II, so had been here since the 40s. And among those people who I met was a man named George Uzawa, who was actually originally from Los Angeles and had come to New York. It was Labor Day of 1943, out of one of the camps, Amachi. And this was really where my work started. So I started interviewing many of the church members. Again, like I said, these longtime residents of New York, Japanese Americans, second generation. And they put me in touch with other people, some who had been church members, some who weren't church members, but were people that they thought I should speak with. And gradually I gathered more and more oral histories. And then I was able to find autobiographies and memoirs and other primary research materials, and I was able to write the story. Now, the thesis and the writing style, which is, I need to address this because this isn't your typical peer-reviewed academic writing. It's a narrative history. And narrative history is a branch of public history, which essentially the definition of public history is making history accessible to a public audience. And I actually have written this piece, which is on the University Press of Colorado website, which goes into discusses what narrative history is. Basic definition of narrative history is storytelling. And in my particular case with this book is community storytelling, telling multiple stories that taken together reveal the larger whole. This book is organized essentially with an introduction and then a summary chapter that discusses the early history It's then divided up into two sections. The first section examines class and status within the community, and then the second section explains how ethnic Japanese American churches help to lessen these divisions. So that's the basic organization, and it's done again with this narrative storytelling emphasis. So the idea was to integrate both the analytical with the narrative together so it could reach a larger audience as well as satisfy the rigors of peer-reviewed scholarship. And you know, there are other examples that that historians have written, so this isn't the only book out there, but for the most part, historians and academics in general do not write these types of books, but there are many other examples. Now, the thesis. So this is the majority view that I was addressing. Ethnicity and race determine social relations. And this is a long-standing view. And which is, for the most part, is accurate. Those are two factors. But it's missing these other factors, class and status. So in recent decade or so, this emerging view that it's not just ethnicity and race, but it's also class and status as well. And these four factors together determine social relations. So class, which is pretty straightforward, economic wealth, right, determines your class standing. However, status is a little more complex, and it's two parts. It's a combination of prestige within the community and then style of life, or how one's lifestyle, is how one lives their life. Class is a Western concept, right? And status is a little more complex. Again, it's an amalgam of both Western and Japanese concepts. Now, the Western, it was first articulated by the German theorist Max Weber, and this was done from a more theoretical perspective. It wasn't applied to any particular community, but so I'm taking this and applying it to the Japanese American community. Oops. And then the Japanese construct of the Nibun system is the other part of status. So it's really a combination of these two, the Western and the Japanese, the Asian constructs combined together that we get at status. Now this chart illustrates how the community was organized or how it was divided up along these status lines. So at the top you have the Kaishin-in, or the Japanese businessmen, which are really a large percentage of New York because the community was relatively small. You know, it was in the few thousand people. And as a consequence, because again, New York being the center of trade and business, it had a large percentage of Japanese businessmen. So you had businessmen obviously in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, but those communities were much larger, whereas New York, because it was smaller, the Kaishin had a larger percentage of the community. So that was important in terms of how the community was oriented. And also you had a few of Issei, the first-generation immigrants, a few of them, you know, merchants and professionals, who also were part of this first tier. The second tier was much smaller. It was mid-sized merchants. The third tier were working-class families and smaller merchants. And then on the bottom, you have the majority of the community, which were the manual laborers and the domestic laborers. Now, I have here this S, and that represents students, and they were not part of the tier because their status was not yet known. So that's why they're separate. So I call it a floating spear. And this includes both the Japanese overseas students, the ryogakusei, as well as Issei and Nisei students, the first and second generation Japanese Americans. Now this tier, this isn't just my conception. It initially was articulated by a man named Ernst Ohori, who was a pastor of a Japanese Christian church. And he first wrote about the existence of this sort of hierarchy in 1908. However, his description did not include the working class families, because at that time, it really had not yet formed. It was just, you know, it was mostly this this male-oriented community, and women had were in such small numbers. But eventually, as more women came through the, you know, picture bride marriages, it did form. And you did start to see working-class families. And my guess is it was probably somewhere around 1920 that we have this fully formed tier of these four groups, or five groups that include the students. So the first section of my book, as I mentioned, focuses on articulating this this hierarchy. And I'll illustrate this by giving a few examples from these tiers. So the first tier, as I mentioned, were the businessmen and also these large merchants and professionals. So Ryo Ichiro Arai and his family would be one example of someone who was on the first tier. Another example is Dr. Toyohiko Campbell Takami. And I'll give you a little background on Dr. Takami. He was born in 1872 in Kumamoto on Kyushu Island. And he came to New York in 1891. Now, you may wonder, well, why is his middle name Campbell? And he took Campbell in honor of Miss Nancy Campbell, who was a retired college teacher who had tutored him when he first came to New York. She tutored him in various academic subjects when he came to Brooklyn. And he came to Brooklyn in large part because, you know, again, that's where the community was at that time, you know, 1891. And she helped him prepare for formal schooling. So he eventually obtained a scholarship to attend a prep school in Lawrenceville. Then, of course, went to college and became a doctor. Went to a, so after he graduated from medical school, he opened a general practice in Brooklyn where he served on the medical staffs of several hospitals and became the chair of the Department of Dermatology at Cumberland Hospital in Brooklyn. In 1907, he founded the Japanese Mutual Aid Society of New York. So he's very actively engaged in the community, which was the predecessor to the Japanese Association. Now, through this Mutual Aid Society, he led the effort to purchase 102 cemetery plots for Japanese at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Maspeth, Queens. And the reason for this was that he wanted to make sure that indigent Japanese had a place where they could be buried and they were not just placed in Potter's Field. He met his wife, Sona, in 1908 when he was delivering a baby at a private residence, and she was working as a nursemaid, as a midwife. And at that time, she was a college student. And I think the story was, well, that she was essentially getting in his way at that time, trying to help him. But eventually they fell in love and they got married. And eventually they lived in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, in a very large house. Really, it was a mansion. It had four floors, and they had several servants. So he became quite wealthy. They also had a large summer estate in Cold Spring Harbor, which had 17 rooms, a tennis court, and a horse stable. So this is the Takami family in 1920. So they had a number of children. And the woman in the middle is one of the servants, the tall woman. And I'm going to read a little bit, because I said this is a narrative history, so I want to read, you know, time permitting, just a few excerpts from the book that kind of are this narrative that I've been talking about here. So the second, actually the eldest son, his name was Ralph Masahiko Takami, and in the summer of 1935, when he was 22 years old, and I'm going to now read from the book, Ralph was 1 year removed from living in Japan. He had traveled to Japan not on his own accord. Both Ralph and his younger brother, Mori, developed bad habits at Lawrenceville School. Instead of concentrating on their studies, they and their school friends spent their evenings with young women in New York nightclubs and joyriding. Along with Prince Kanoi and Count Terashima, who were the sons of Japanese diplomats, and they were also attending Lawrenceville, the Takami brothers partied with some of the sons of millionaire ranchers from Hawaii and with Dan Topping and his younger brother Bob Topping. Dan Topping was the same age as Ralph, and Bob was 1 year older than Maury. Their parents were husband and wife millionaires, Henry J. and Rhea Reed Topping. The Toppings' wealth emanated from Henry Topping's father, John A. Topping, who had served as president of the Republic Iron and Steel Company and of the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company, and from Rhea Topping's father, Daniel Reed, who had served as president of the American Tin Plate Company and had been a majority shareholder of the American Can Company. Reed was known as the Tin Plate King. After Dan Topping graduated from the Lawrenceville School in 1930, he attended the University of Pennsylvania, but did not graduate. Typically sporting a tan complexion, Topping had a penchant for nightclubbing and for attractive women. His six wives included Arlene Judge, a B-movie actress, who later married Dan's brother Bob, and Sonja Henie, the Norwegian former Olympic figure skating champion and actress. And Dan Topping went on to purchase the New York Yankees. He was the owner from the late 40s until he sold it to CBS in the 1960s. So again, returning to this narrative, Ralph somehow managed to gain admission to Princeton University. After 1 year, he flunked out. And incensed, Dr. Takami thought part of the problem was his eldest son's association with wealthy friends who did little but fool around and carouse. To separate Ralph from these negative influences, Dr. Takami sent his son to live and work in Japan. Although Ralph had only a rudimentary knowledge of the Japanese language, Count Kawayama, who was a family friend and very influential in the Japanese government, helped him obtain a job as a reporter for a Japanese newspaper. In early 1934, the newspaper assigned Ralph to cover Japan's installation of Henry Puyi as Emperor of Manchukuo, which was a puppet state that Japan had created, Manchuria. The ceremony was held on March 1st. An ethnic Manchu, Puyi was the last emperor of the Qing dynasty in China. The Chinese Revolution of 1911 had forced Puyi to abdicate the throne in 1912 when he was 6 years old. With Japanese assistance, Puyi fled China and moved to South Manchuria, actually to a hotel, in Port Arthur on the southern tip of Manchuria. Ralph returned home in June of 1934. Princeton University had permitted him to return to complete his undergraduate studies. In 1936, Dr. Takami asked a young Nisei woman named Grace Ijima if she knew a nice, quote, Japanese, unquote, girl whom Ralph could escort to a Princeton dance. So Dr. Callie was thinking of, you know, of marriage for his son. According to Ijima, she was out of the picture as a potential date because she was 2 years older than Ralph. However, she did know an unattached Nisei girl from her days at Barnard named Ikuo Kondo, who was about 4 years younger than Ralph. Ijima told Dr. Takami that although Kondo was a Nisei, she was quite Japanese in attitude. Trusting Ijima's judgment, Dr. Takami asked her to contact Kondo and arrange a date with her son. A gifted classical pianist, Kondo was attending the Juilliard School of Music, which was then located on Claremont Avenue, just north of Columbia University. Kondo was born and raised in Lyndhurst, New Jersey, and had been valedictorian of her high school class. She had graduated from Barnard College in 1935 when she was 19 years old. Ikuo and Ralph fell in love and became engaged during the summer of 1936. In the autumn, Ikuo traveled to a Christian women's college in Japan to study piano for 1 year. They planned to marry when she returned to the United States in 1937. While Ikuo was in Japan, Ralph managed to graduate from Princeton. Dr. Takami contacted his Issei friend, Yoji Bunny Sekine, about a possible job for Ralph. Sekine owned a toothbrush and dental plate denture brush manufacturing company named the I. Sekine Company, which had offices in Manhattan and in Kobe, Japan, and a factory in Baltimore, Maryland. Sekine found work for Ralph in his Baltimore factory. When Ikuo Kondo returned from Japan, she was ill. with a streptococcus infection, which was potentially fatal at the time because penicillin was not yet available to treat it. She also had a weak heart from having had rheumatic fever as a child. Her condition gradually deteriorated. Before their marriage on November 28, 1937, doctors confirmed that Iku was unlikely to survive. Less than 4 months later, on March 10, 1938, Iku died at the age of 22. Shortly after his wife's death, Ralph re-examined his own life. He asked himself why someone with such a bright and promising future as Iku had to die tragically. He decided to study medicine to help young people avoid Iku's fate. He quit his manufacturing job with the Second A Company in Baltimore. He then applied and received admission to New York University Medical School. Dr. Takami would live long enough to see his eldest son complete medical school and pass his medical licensing exams. So that's a little bit of, again, of the narrative, and also a little bit to illustrate how the first tier lived. As one example, and I have other examples. I also talk about Dr. Takamine and a little bit about the Arise as well. So the second tier now, getting back to our chart here, the second tier included a man named Senzo Kuoyama, who was born in 1876 in what is now Niigata Prefecture. Kuoyama arrived in New York in 1901. He started as a domestic servant, so he actually started as someone on the fourth tier. See, he didn't have much formal education. However, he worked as a cook for a private family, saved his money. He also made many stock market investments and was fairly good at that. And eventually was able to afford to travel to Japan in 1908 to organize a memorial service for his mother, who had recently passed. While in Japan, he met a very distant relative who wanted Kuoyama to meet his daughter, Kuma. They married soon thereafter, and Kuoyama returned alone to New York, assuring his wife that he would send for her as soon as he had saved enough money to support her and possible children. They corresponded by letter for almost 3 years, and Kuma repeatedly requested to join Senzo in New York. But Senzo said that his stock market earnings were less than he had forecasted. So I'll read a little bit about this now. So now they're, Kuma is in Japan, Senzo is in New York, and this is what happened. In the autumn of 1911, Senzo received a telegram that stated, quote, "Please come and meet me in Seattle as I will board tomorrow, Kuma Kuoyama." Kuma's telegram befuddled Senzo because he did not think that she was brave enough to travel by herself to America. Senzo explained his predicament to Mr. Thompson, who was his employer. The master, which is referred to at that time as domestic to the owner, the master readily granted his cook leave so that he could meet his wife in Seattle. Kuoyama traveled by train from New York to Seattle and arrived in time to meet the ship carrying his wife. When he approached the pier, he noticed many other Issei men waiting for their wives. As the ship approached the pier, he saw the picture brides leaning against railings and anxiously scanning the dock and the surrounding area for their husbands. They were all dressed in kimonos. He counted more than 40 picture brides on the ship. He then turned to look at the Issei men on the pier, and they were staring intently at the passengers on the ship. He thought to himself that unlike these men, he would have little difficulty finding his wife because he had already met her. The other men had only seen pictures of their brides. As he glanced back and forth between the pier and the ship, he noticed that both the men and the women seemed reserved and dignified. Their faces showed little visible emotion when partners found each other. It was a pointed contrast to the jubilant pier scenes that he had witnessed in New York City, when European men boisterously greeted and passionately kissed their picture brides who had arrived from Southern and Eastern Europe. Kuoyama had time to focus on the other Issei couples because he had not yet spotted Kuma. After seemingly all the picture brides had found their husbands and debarked from the ship, Kuoyama boarded the ship to search for Kuma. Maybe she was ill. When his search proved fruitless, he visited the ship's office manager and learned that Kuma had not boarded the ship. Kuoyama's mind was filled with worry about his missing wife. He was unable to ascertain her whereabouts and decided it was best for him to return to New York and wait for her or her parents to contact him there. When he finally arrived home, he received word that Kuma had missed the ship, but would take the next ship bound for Seattle. Rather than make the long journey back to Seattle, he wired his wife that he would meet her halfway in Chicago. This time, everything went as planned. Kuoyama brought his wife to live with him at the Thompson house. The Thompsons agreed to hire Kuma as a servant as well. So eventually, as I said, Kuoyama was saving his money and he was investing. He eventually was able to purchase a grocery store and a restaurant and boarding house, a combination restaurant and boarding house. He's probably best remembered for having founded and operated Miyako Restaurant, which was originally located on West 58th Street in Midtown and then on West 56th Street in Midtown. This is a postcard of Miyako in the interior, the restaurant and the bar area. Founded in 1914, Miyako remained in business for more than 60 years. Eventually, Kuoyama's daughter took over the operation. Although there were at least a dozen other Japanese restaurants in Manhattan between the 1920s and early 1950s, the Miyako was the largest and most elegant of these restaurants and generally catered to a white, upscale clientele. And the reason for this was because the Japanese population was so small, Kuoyama knew he had to appeal to a larger clientele. And at this time, most people were not familiar with Japanese food. This is like the 1914, 1920s. They just hadn't, there were very few Japanese restaurants. So I discussed this in the book. He created dishes that he thought would be more appealing to the American palate as opposed to traditional Japanese dishes. As I mentioned, he also operated a small grocery store, and he began manufacturing arare, which is a Japanese rice cracker, and he sold this in bulk to major department stores, which was something that there was arare on the West Coast, but those are typically sold in Japanese grocery stores in Japan towns. And Kuoyama thought, gee, this would have broader appeal. So he was the first person to market it to Macy's and some of these major departments, Bloomingdale's and such, Charles and Company. And it was marketed as Japanese cocktail crackers. And it became very popular. He eventually, when he became older, he decided to close down operations. I think in the late 30s, he finally said, I'll have to shut it down. So he was it's just too difficult to both manufacture it and distribute it as well. So that's the second tier. Now, the book continues on with narratives on people on the third and fourth tiers. So these are the small merchants, the working class families, and the bachelor laborers. And then also discusses students. So an example, this is a photograph of someone who at the time was a student. These are student laborers, the Dekasegi Shosei. In many cases, student laborers, so they'd come from Japan to attend high school and college in the United States, but they had very little money. And so they usually went to school part-time, night school in many cases, and then they worked full-time as well. And as a consequence, also you had issues with language. It was just very difficult, as you could imagine. And so many of them did not finish school. Or the ones that did graduate, they faced racially based employment discrimination, and they couldn't find jobs in their field. And this was more the case on the West Coast, but also in New York as well. There was race-based employment discrimination in New York as well. So what happened to many of these people is that they became domestic laborers or manual laborers because these are the only jobs that they could get. So again, they worked in households, they worked in restaurants, they worked in some cases in digging ditches, things like that. And so this is what happened to many of these people. So one example I have here is a man named Yama. I don't have his full name. It could be that he didn't want to give his full name. And So there's a brief passage about Yama. The typical day of a bachelor called Yama was not unlike that of many other bachelor menial laborers. When he was 16 years old, Yama left his home in Japan to work as a seaman aboard various ships that took him around the world. When a ship that he was aboard docked in Brooklyn, he walked across the gangway and did not return to the ship. An undocumented immigrant, he held various odd jobs until he secured the job of day cook at the Tokyo three-decker sandwich shop. There were a number of these sandwich shops, and they were just basically American, sandwich shops. But a number of these Japanese laborers found jobs there. This was an Issei-owned and operated American diner known as sandwich shops, were relatively commonplace in New York. After work, Yama prepared a simple meal at the restaurant for his lunch. He then went off to an off-track location that took racing bets. Between races, he consumed Boilermakers, shots of straight whiskey followed by beer chasers. After the last race, or sooner, if the money in his pockets was gone, he staggered back to his small rented room and soon fell sound asleep on his twin bed. Early the next morning, Yama was back at work at the restaurant. His wages as a cook enabled him to pay his rent and enjoy his leisure time as he desired. He utilized some of his wages to purchase a $1,000 life insurance policy to pay for his burial costs. Yama did not want the Nihon Jinkai, or the Japanese Association, to pay for his burial because he considered himself self-reliant and had too much pride to rely on the charity of others. The Japanese Association paid the burial costs of indigent Nikkei, or people of Japanese ancestry, and arranged for their burial in the Japanese plot at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Maspeth, Queens. So this was the cemetery, again, that Dr. Takami had helped to establish. So that's the fourth tier, or a little bit on the fourth tier. So as I mentioned, the second section of my book then examines how the community managed to stay together in some way. We discuss how the Japanese Association, for example, provided social welfare services. There also were some sports clubs, Kendo Club. But it was the three Japanese Christian churches, later joined by a Japanese Buddhist church after its founding in 1938. So the Japanese Christian churches were founded roughly in the late 1890s until the early first decade of the 20th century. And the Buddhist church wasn't until much later. So because of that, the Christian churches were the primary bridges to create, the semblance of the Japanese community through shared language, customs, culture, and food. So one of these churches was Shudokai, Japanese Christian Association. So this is from an Easter photograph. Every Easter they took photographs. So if you go to the Japanese American United Church in their archive, they have all of these photographs. So this is from 1933. However, despite the efforts of these social organizations and the churches, these divisions remain, which I think helps to show how sharp these divisions were, how strong they were. The churches themselves in some ways were divided. There was one church that had mostly merchant people and business people, and then the other churches had more working class families. So the churches were also divided in a sense as well. Now, a case which illustrates the importance of status is that of Kyujiro Fujigami. Now, he was born in 1879 in Fukuoka Prefecture. Fujigami was a plant nursery operator, and he owned the Ozone Park Nursery in Ozone Park, Queens. He came to America in 1902. And how he came here was, again, he was on a ship, on a schooner, and he jumped ship in Philadelphia. So, again, another example of an undocumented immigrant. So America has a long history of undocumented immigrants, and they have contributed much to our society. Now, in Fujigami's case, he initially worked as a gardener, and in the early 19-teens, he purchased a farm in Woodside, Queens, and eventually started a greenhouse business. He married for the second time in 1913 to an Issei woman who was from his same hometown in Fukuoka. Their son, this is kind of an aside, their son later became a professional stock car driver. Fujigami's greenhouse was especially profitable during the Christmas and Easter seasons. He grew poinsettias from cuttings and Easter lilies from bulbs. And how long are we doing on time? We still have plenty of time? Okay. I'll read a brief passage here from Fujigami. While other local greenhouse operators sold poinsettias, Easter lilies were difficult to obtain in the tri-state region. Fujigami had contracted with Easter lily producers in the Riku Islands to sell him the bulbs. Japanese Easter lilies are native to the Riku Islands. The Japanese Easter lily has a fragrant, pure white blossom that resembles the bell part of a trumpet. Inside each blossom are six stamens with orange anthers. Between 1898 and 1941, nearly all Easter lily plants sold in the United States came from bulbs harvested in the Rikus. Fujigami realized that he could make a financial bonanza during the Easter season if he had more greenhouses to grow the plants. In 1930, he convinced the owner of Metropolitan Greenhouses to finance and construct on his property 20 greenhouses and two large boilers and a 100-foot chimney to heat the greenhouses. Fujigami explained that if he had 20 additional greenhouses to complement his existing six greenhouses, he could produce and sell enough Easter lilies in one season to pay Metropolitan Greenhouses' construction bid. Despite Fujigami's persuasiveness, it is probable that Metropolitan Greenhouses would not have entered into the contract but for the effects of the Great Depression of the 1930s. Remember, this is still a time of racism. You know, you could say even today, but certainly at that time. The depressed economy had brought one greenhouse construction business to a standstill, and the owner of Metropolitan Greenhouses was desperate for work. The 26 greenhouses enabled Fujigami to raise thousands of Easter lilies. He had the entire crop ready for the 1931 Easter season. He sold enough lilies that Easter to pay in full what he owed to Metropolitan Greenhouses. Fujigami became the first person to cultivate and sell Easter lilies in large quantities on the Atlantic coast of North America, and soon amassed a considerable fortune. Now, although he had substantial economic wealth, which again is that one criteria, right, for gaining a high level within the community, he only had modest status within the community. As a consequence of that, he was really kept on this third tier. Because Fujigami's occupation was connected to agriculture and he resided in distant Ozone Park, Queens, both the Japanese and Japanese-American communities in New York did not accord him high status. Agriculture was associated with pre-industrial Japan and atavistic occupation. So, again, this shows how these factors functioned. These class and status divisions were not limited to the New York Japanese community. And that's a point that I want to emphasize. So far, I've only been talking about Japanese and Japanese Americans in New York. You're thinking, okay, isn't that kind of narrow? I mean, what about other communities? And I found that actually there was another community that also had these similar divisions. The historian Andrea Geiger had found similar class and status divisions in Japanese American communities in the Western United States and in Canada, so again, not just New York, but also other historians and sociologists have found divisions among German American communities. They had, again, these similar class, status, spatial divisions, as well as religious and political. Now, in contrast, German-Americans and Japanese-Americans. The Japanese population in 1938 in New York was about 3,300, and that's a rough estimate. We don't know the exact number because of census undercounting, but roughly around that. Could have been as high as 4,500. In contrast, the German ethnic population in New York was around 300,000 in 1870. And there were distinct German neighborhoods that formed on the Lower East Side. For example, this is Ozone Park Nursery. And this is an example of a drawing of Easterlight. Sorry, I missed these. But we have, for example, Klein Deutschland, which is formed on the Lower East Side. Very large German-American population. And then later, Yorkville in the East 80s formed, and again, another large German-American population. However, as early as the 1890s, following the end of large-scale German immigration to the United States, there were signs of decline in German-American communities, and largely attributable to these class status, religious, political, and other divisions. According to historian Russell Kozel, the German Philadelphia of 1900 was distinguished by its heterogeneity. It was actually a collection of largely separate worlds, loosely linked by a sense of common Germanness. So very similar to the Japanese-American community in New York. And as I said, other historians have found similar divisions among Japanese-Americans in other parts, whether it's Los Angeles or other parts out in the West. And as we know today, really, Yorkville is not a German-American community anymore, and Klein Deutschland is, you know, has long disappeared. Really disappeared around 1920, it was gone. So to conclude, I wanted to just briefly read about another gentleman. This is a man named Ryuzo Yamasaki, who was the owner of this, eventually, of the Oriental Tea Trading Company. And he was a small merchant, so he would be situated somewhere on the third tier. And his story was that he was highly educated. So that's an education was not always a determinant of where you would wind up. He was a graduate of a technical school in Japan, which is the equivalent of a three-year liberal arts college in the United States. He earned a degree in textile chemistry. However, when he came to America, he realized that there really weren't any jobs for what he specialized in, which was textile dyeing and weaving. And he wound up going from odd job to job and really couldn't find anything where he could make a living at, or would be where he would be able to get a promotion, or he could, one case he was discriminated against where he wasn't paid as much as the other employees. And eventually he said, well, I guess I'm going to have to go into business for myself if I'm ever going to make a living. So he eventually established this tea and coffee trading store, tea and coffee retail store in Hamilton Heights. Ryuzo worked at the store, and I'm reading now from the book. Ryuzo worked at the store 6 days per week. He always dressed impeccably, wearing a suit and tie every workday. He opened the store at 7:30 in the morning and closed it either at 7 or 8 in the evening on weekdays. On Saturdays, he worked at the store from 7 a.m. until 11 p.m. because there was a city college at a Lewiston Stadium. They had concerts there, and so people would walk from after the concert up past his store. So that's why he kept it open late on Saturdays. The coffee and tea business was profitable most years, but the Yamasaki family also endured hard times, especially during the Great Depression of the 1930s. While Yamasaki had no paid employees, his family assisted him in the store. His daughter, Masako, often helped her father during the 1930s because his health was sometimes subpar. On some days, only two or three customers visited the store between 7:30 a.m. and closing time in the evening. At the end of every business day, Ryuzo opened the cash register and counted the income for that day. No matter how little money was in the cash register, Ryuzo always had a positive mindset and a smile on his face. For him, every day was, quote, a great day. Masako remembered that her father was like sunshine. Although he was quiet and placid, Ryuzo also had a sanguine disposition around everyone he encountered. A person's class and status background made no difference to him. He treated everyone the same. He showed that he truly cared about people in his actions and words. Whenever an Issei entered his store to borrow a few dollars, for example, Yamasaki always spared what he could and then extended his right hand for a handshake. Yamasaki believed that an Issei, regardless of his background, would not ask for a handout unless he was desperate. Yamasaki knew that most Issei would make every effort to repay the debt. A European-American customer who was slowly dying of an incurable disease would often spend hours in the cramped store and just talk about whatever was on his mind. Yamasaki did not ever ask the man to leave or even indicate in his facial expressions and body gestures that he was displeased. Other customers remarked that Yamasaki was, quote, already in heaven because he treated them so courteously, encouraged them to work toward their ambitions and goals, and showed that he was sincerely interested in their well-being. So these narratives taken together reveal not just about Japanese New Yorkers, but also about the immigrant experience, the American experience, the Japanese experience, and more broadly, the human experience. Thank you.